Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk. And this here is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Heidi Blickenstaff.
Hi, my girls.
Hey, girl.
Hey, girls. Hey.
We are so happy that Heidi is here today. We are so thrilled that she's coming on the show to discuss true crime. And we just wanted to say right off the bat, Heidi, you have a phenomenally amazing career. You are a Helen Hayes Award winner. You're an original co-creator and star of Title of Show. You're a star of several Broadway shows. You're also a star of Disney's Freaky Friday. And while all of that is genius and amazing, and it's also going to be on my personal resume as soon as we get off of this particular call, we are not here to talk about any of that today.
Nope.
And we
she affirmed you. She said nope.
Nope, okay, I'm relieved, actually.
She's relieved. Okay, we just, mm-hmm. we need to
I'm
make
just
sure.
I'm tired of talking about myself. Let's talk about murder, shall we?
You know, you're the second relieved with Kristen Chenoweth, who was our first guest. That was her comment, relieved. I always love to hear what the guest is going to say.
Yeah, and most guests are like, thank you. I don't.
Thank God. Thank God.
Well, this is truly amazing to talk about this stuff because you guys are weirdos like I am. And I was very psyched that you started doing this.
We have had it dog-eared for a few months. Like, we got to call Heidi. We got to call Heidi. We got to call Heidi. And we're there. So here we are. And freaks, that's how Jess and I feel. And a lot of our guests feel. So we want to know about your freak lineage. Why are you interested in true crime? What's your OG story? Are there shows you watch? And why do you think we all are freaks and such and whatnot?
Isn't it interesting? My husband often wonders, why are you watching all that stuff? Why do you listen to all the podcasts? I've thought about this because I've listened to your other episodes, and I know you ask this of your guests. I think that for the same reason I'm interested in acting and all things creative, I am interested in human psychology. And I truly love taking a deep dive into the characters I play. And there's also something about the mental pathology about these crazy people that do these terrible, terrible things that I'm also genuinely interested in. And also, there's another piece that I feel like I'm one of those people that is always, I've got a plan in mind. I've got an exit strategy in mind. And maybe it's because I live in New York City. I don't know why, but I'm definitely one of those people that I want to know how I'm going to get out of a situation. If it goes sideways, I size people up. If somebody just is not hitting it right for me, I'm always wondering what else is going on. I'm trepidatious of a lot of strangers. And
Heidi, give us an example. Heidi, give us an example of what you would do as an exit strategy. Like, you've got the exit strategies in mind. Give us one of those. Like, if you're at home sleeping and something happens, or what's your number one, like, this is the shit that I'm gonna do.
Right.
Should I be killed?
Right. Well, I do sleep with a baseball bat next to my bed.
Damn, Gina.
Yes. And I've done that for years. And I do walk around the city with mace in my pocket. I'm definitely one of those people. But I'm also one of those people that some stuff has happened to me while I have innocently walked the streets of New York City. And I've never been mugged. I've never had anything that awful happen to me, but I've been grabbed from behind by a drunk guy. And I'm always thinking, okay, like if I see a shifty guy, I'm always like, all right, I've got him in the corner of my eye. See that guy on the subway platform? I'm clocking him the entire time. I'm getting as far away from him as I can on the subway. If I need to move to another car, I will trust my fear and move to another car. I don't care if I offend anybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't really know where all of that comes from, except I've maybe been living in New York too long.
Do you guys think that the reason we are this way is because we finally have all the knowledge of these crimes that did happen in days of yore? Because when we were kids, for example, I don't remember being as aware as I am now. And in the wrestling of even talking about this subject, that is, I think, one of the benefits of talking about this subject is it can help people protect themselves more. Not to victim shame, because anything can happen to anybody, no matter how careful you are. But I do think about that sometimes. Like, in a way, I'm glad that we talk about it and there are shows like this, because I wasn't aware of this as I got on my bike with no helmet as a kid,
right,
by myself in the middle of nowhere.
Well, or like, right, you know, I used to play manhunt like after dark in my neighborhood, just the kids of the neighborhood, like no parents around, with flashlights. And like, do we think that shit would happen today? That is a hard pass. And also, knowledge is power, and we're women too. So that's another whole layer of getting into like teenagers or before you go to college or when you're, you know, you get at least I was made aware of like, you know, somebody slipping something in your drink or, you know, being followed, or that's the stuff Jen and I have talked about this before. That's the stuff as a chick that you're like, okay, well, I have to be extra aware of this, and men don't necessarily have the same issue.
Would you be a helicopter parent? Would you guys, are you helicopter parents, do you think, in your heart? Or do you have a stepchild, Heidi?
I have two stepsons. You know, they're boys, first of all. So exactly what you're saying, Jess, like there's a difference there. I think as women, we are predisposed to, you know, have an exit strategy or just have our feelers out for what could happen. And I don't think that men have to deal with that on the regular like we do. But, you know, I came into my stepsons' lives when they were 10 and 7. And, you know, they're so great and independent, and they have such great parents, their biological parents. And so, I don't know. I mean, they've had some stuff happen to them. I had one of my sons had, he was mugged on the street, and that terrified me. And, you know, I had all these rules for him after that happened. And, you know, the good news is they're New York kids. They're super savvy and they're boys. So they don't have to walk around being on guard all the time. Like
I am not a parent yet. And I was, for all of those listeners listening at this time, I'm currently taking care of a little puppy right now for my parents, and the puppy is 13 weeks. And I feel like maybe I should never be a parent only because it's a lot. Like I feel like maybe I wouldn't be excited and be a helicopter parent in that way, because I find myself being like, I'm looking at the dog chewing my shoe and I'm like, go ahead, girl, do it, girl. And my mom's like, you can't let her do that. And I'm like, well, I just want a sandwich, you know? And so I don't think I'm a good person, you know?
You're a great person. I do have a question, Heidi, before we get to the case. You said you sleep with a baseball bat. Do you ever worry about, oh, is this baseball bat going to be used against me?
That is so interesting. I don't ever worry about that. I heard you say something like that about like having a gun under your mattress. I heard on one of your podcasts, you were like, but then it's going to be used against me. For some reason, that is not my worry. The thing that does worry me is that I sleepwalk.
We just did an episode on this.
When I don't know somebody's middle name, this is what I do. Heidi Janine. Oh my God.
Yeah. It's tricky. The sleepwalking is a tricky thing, because my sleepwalking is mostly sitting up and sleep talking, but occasionally I have been known to walk, which is why I have to be careful with weapons in my house. I don't think I would ever commit a crime in my sleep. I've never done that so far, but mostly what I do is I convince people around me in my sleep that we are all in danger.
Heidi.
Which is terrible. And this is what I'm talking about, how I'm always like a cat poised to jump. And which is why I've always been interested in true crime. I think that in my unconscious, I don't know, like thinking that something terrible is going to happen, and I create these stories, and I will wake my husband up and I will be like 98% asleep. And I will tell him, listen, there's someone in the house. Just listen to me carefully. Don't panic. We're going to have to make a plan. And he knows now that I am totally full of shit. And he knows like he needs to go pee and I'll wake up. And so he's like, why don't you go pee and we can have this talk when you're done peeing.
Okay. This is fucking genius. First of all, that you are the character from Bridesmaids. He's like, there's somebody on the plane. There's somebody on the wing of the plane. There is an Amish woman on the wing of the plane, and we are going down. Something is happening. We are crashing.
I am that person.
Wow.
Here's a quick story. I was on tour once on a tragic special contract, and I had a roommate, and I jumped on him in the middle of the night. I went from my bed to his bed. I jumped on him. I put my hands over his mouth and I said, don't say a word. They're about to kidnap us for the Kidnap Olympics. And it was a whole thing in the Olympics that they like, you have to be like sort of like a Navy SEAL in that kind of shape. And they kidnap you and they put you in some kind of situation and you get out of it. And I was telling him they're coming for us and we were going to the Kidnap Olympics.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the sequel to the homicidal sleepwalking episode we did with Max Crum. Heidi, give that a listen and please report back to us if any of that sounds viable and familiar.
Wow. This has made my entire day. You have no idea. And so our day can be made further. We are ready at this time, dear Heidi Janine, to talk about our case, which is in Fresno, California, which is where you grew up. Is this correct?
Yep, that's where I was born and raised.
Okay. And for our listeners out there, we always toss a couple of cases out there to our guests, or our guests can choose the case. And Heidi, she did choose this case for us today. So we're going to dive right in. But we always do this, credit where credit is due. We've got our information today from Wikipedia, Murderpedia, CBS News, the Associated Press, an article by Ian Jobling called "The Crime the Media Chose to Ignore," as well as misty.angelcities.com. This is the story of the Wesson crimes. So Fresno means ash tree, and it's reminiscent of many cities in California, which began under Mexican rule. As the city emerged into a rich blend of metropolitan life mixed with small town living, this super culturally diverse city has grown to a population surpassing about 400,000 people with 90 different nationalities. Now, the Fresno climate, and you tell us if we're right here, Heidi, is moderate. Okay. Would you agree the climate is moderate?
I would say that at times it's unbearably hot. It's like in the valley, and the summers are like just like crazy desert hot and dry.
Okay. So Fresno, the climate is unbearable at times. And the town is located near three of America's national parks. That's Yosemite National Park, Sequoia, and Kings Canyon National Parks. Heidi, have you been?
Of course. I spent my youth like going to all those parks at all different times of the years. We skied up there.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So they're so beautiful. And, you know, every time I get to California, every time I go back, my family is all still in Fresno. And every time I go back there, I'm like, bye, I'm going to Yosemite. They're like, but you just got here. But it's so beautiful there.
You wouldn't be able to get me out either. Yeah. Now, the city is also home to many famous racing drivers, including well-known Bill Vukovich, as well as our very own Broadway star, Heidi Blickenstaff. Now, Marcus Wesson, who's the protagonist of today's story, or antagonist, really, was born in Kansas, the eldest of four children of Benjamin and Carrie Wesson. He was raised as a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Wesson claimed that his mother was a religious fanatic, his father was an alcoholic, and also child abuser who abandoned the family when Wesson was a child. So by the early 1960s, the family had moved to San Bernardino, California. And after dropping out of high school, Wesson joined the Army, serving from 1966 to 1968. And in 1968, he moved to San Jose, California. And then in his 20s, he moved in with Rosemary Maturina, who was in her 30s. And the two had one son. Now, trigger warning, basically from here on out, I know we're at the very beginning, but trigger warning here. Wesson then began sexually assaulting Rosemary's 8-year-old daughter, Elizabeth. When she turned 15, he married her as well. So now he has two wives. And 4 months after marrying Elizabeth, she gave birth to her first child, and over the next 16 years had 10 more children. Now, you can't see this, listeners, but if you were a viewer, Heidi very appropriately threw up 10 fingers.
It's just unbelievable to me. It's this whole story, and it just gets darker and grosser. Continue.
It's truly awful. Thank you, Heidi. Now, we said, 10 children. Just think about that. I don't want to, but that's what it is. Now, one of Elizabeth's younger sisters left her own 7 children with them, claiming to be unable to care for them at the time. So this all resulted in a household of considerable size. I mean, that's quite large. So on top of all this, Mr. Wesson could not keep a steady job. He got most of his income from welfare, and the family drifted from place to place, and some of its living arrangements were pretty inventive, actually. At one time, the family lived on a 26-foot boat moored in Santa Cruz Harbor. Mr. Wesson sometimes scavenged hamburgers out of a McDonald's dumpster for his family to eat. Now, the boat got him in trouble. However, he failed to list it as an asset on his welfare forms, and he went to jail for welfare fraud in 1990. And in the mid to late 1990s, the family lived in a trailer and a large army tent in the Santa Cruz Mountains on land with no running water. So the Wessons also lived for a time in a decaying 63-foot tugboat off the shore of Marin County, California. And sometimes they lived in a school bus. So by the late 1990s, the children of Marcus and Elizabeth Wesson, they were old enough to work, and Mr. Wesson used their money to buy the Fresno building in which the murders took place. This is like...
I told you this was deep and dark. This guy is like, you know, this is what I'm talking about, like the pathology of someone's mental illness. I mean, and how he just spiraled down.
To somehow make all of these things happen in such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
And again, Jen and I always talk about the, you know, sociopaths versus psychopaths and how the brain looks. If you were to cut his brain open, it's not going to look like ours does, because there's some stuff going on in there that's not, you know, wires are crossing that are not, that are not making any sense.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I can't believe how much the state of California let those kids down, like how all of those kids were running around, and he was homeschooling them, I think. Right. But like,
you're psychic. We're just about to talk about that. Yeah.
Take it away.
As you're saying, none of the children ever went to school. Mr. Wesson taught them from home using flashcards, school textbooks, and his own brand of Christianity. He became fascinated, apparently, with David Koresh during the siege at Waco, Texas in 93, and made his family into his own personal cult.
We've
done a lot of episodes on cults recently, and it sounds just like that. He described himself as Jesus Christ and police officers to Satan. When the family watched television coverage of the Branch Davidian siege, Mr. Wesson told the children, quote, "This is how the world is attacking God's people. This man is just like me. He is making children for the Lord. That's what we should be doing, making children for the Lord," end quote. Mr. Wesson taught his family to be prepared to die if anyone ever tried to break up the household. He told his niece, Rosa Solorio, and his daughter, Sabrina Wesson, they were, quote, strong soldiers who would hunt down and kill family members who betrayed him and who might have to kill the family and themselves to prevent a breakup. Possibly in anticipation of such a massacre, Mr. Wesson bought 10 coffins from an antique dealer. Can you imagine being kids and just seeing coffins around the house? That, like,
no.
That, yeah.
That's totally bananas. That must have been terrifying and, at the very least, completely strange and, like, confusing.
I mean, the therapy. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, the therapy, if you think about it, and, you know, that you're going to need after something like this because it's so traumatic as a kid.
And the house that they lived in was very small. So all of those coffins had to take up a lot of room. So it's not like they were, like, in a back room somewhere. It had to have been where they saw them all the time.
And also, so, I just want to point out that when he's prepared, like, he's doing all this preparedness for bad things that are going to happen, that's very unlike what Heidi does. It's the antithesis. Okay. Okay.
That's right. So Mr. Wesson was also fascinated by vampires and gave himself and his daughters and nieces vampire names.
No.
His name for himself was, are you ready? Here we go. Jeva Marcus Spire, which is a mixture of Jesus, Marcus, and vampire. And I know this is a very serious story, but I cannot help but think if it were us, it would be Jeva Genis Spire or Jeva Jessis Spire or Jeva Broadway Heidi Pire. Spire. What?
Heidi Broadway Pire.
Yeah, I was going to say, we broke up our, like, Jessica Lovers Spire.
I know. Like, what's the deity that you believe in?
The deity that I believe in is pasta.
So it has to be your name attached to vampire, attached to whatever, like, you.
Yeah. He believed his name was Jesus. Okay.
So something you believe in, your name, vampire.
Yeah.
Belting Heidi Pyre.
Ooh, baby.
That's good.
That's good.
Jen?
Oh, something I believe in. Okay. Keto Genipire.
I hate keto.
I do too. I just couldn't think of anything.
And mine is Gnocchi Jessivapire.
That feels right.
Have you all heard what Bob Ruff is up to in 2021? If you don't know who he is, you should. Bob is the host of the hit true crime podcast, Truth and Justice. I remember first seeing him on the documentary Adnan Syed, Innocent or Guilty. He's truly amazing. And he's just launched a new show that we're obsessed with. In fact, we're going to be guests on his new show. Woohoo!
It's such a cool concept. You need to check out True Crime Binge. It's like true crime podcast lovers version of Rogan's. Every week, Bob is joined on the show by another true crime podcast host. So it's a great way to get to know the podcast hosts that you already love and discover new shows that you might be unaware of. Bob has a way of getting his guests to really open up. For example, Jen, did you know that Payne Lindsay was in a boy band before creating Up and Vanished? Or that Laura Richards recently got engaged? Or that David Rickin records himself eating breakfast?
I did not know.
Well, now you know. Now you can learn about these podcast hosts' personal lives, their production, and there's always a discussion about a case of the week. Now you hear Bob and Nick from True Crime Garage pick apart the Delphi murders. Christine Schieffer from And That's Why We Drink break down the triumphant story of Miriam Rodriguez's hunt for her daughter's killers and more.
That sounds amazing. And here's the best part. True Crime Binge is the perfect place to find new true crime podcasts to binge. Jess and I are always on the lookout for new things because we binged most of our faves. Bob has already released some great episodes with fantastic guests with more to come, including yours truly, us.
So download and subscribe to True Crime Binge today, wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday. Check it out and you might just find your next true crime binge.
Okay. Thank you. All right, now that we're going to hell, let's talk more about Mr. Wesson and trigger warnings throughout. He began sexually assaulting his daughters and nieces after he got out of jail in 1990. According to trial testimony of one of his nieces, Ruby, Wesson began molesting her when she was 8. She testified that she loved Mr. Wesson and she loved him at that time. And at age 13, enthusiastically agreed to marry him, of course, because she was a kid. The marriage ceremony consisted of the couple putting their hands on the Bible and reciting marriage vows. Mr. Wesson married 3 of his nieces and 2 of his daughters this way and had children by all of them. Ruby testified that Mr. Wesson could be cruel and jealous. He isolated his children from the outside world and beat her with a stick or baseball bat. Heidi?
Yeah, well, I've got my baby.
Okay. Despite this abuse, many in the family remember their days with Mr. Wesson. He devised entertainments for the family, such as plays, concerts, and ugly contests in which the children would dress up to be as ugly as possible. Oh, I would win, you guys. I would win.
Okay. Listen,
I'm looking at the 3 of us. I've got it.
I am very, this is absolutely a cult. Do you know what I mean?
For sure.
Like we talked to a former member of the NXIVM cult, mm-hmm. which I was obsessed with the story of. And, you know, she was the whistleblower of the whole cult. All of these things are cult. This is cult shit.
Sure.
I'm putting together a talent night, you guys. And just bizarre. It's bizarre.
But also
poor kids.
Isn't it interesting that one of the games he would play was an ugly contest? You know, that's the psychology of this guy that like, it's certainly not the opposite. It's something that is demeaning. And, you know, also, yes. did you guys find in your research that there were boys in the household too? He didn't.
Yes.
It wasn't just girls, and the boys and the girls were separated and the girls were not allowed to talk to the boys because he felt like that would bring about sexual feelings, because incest in this house is completely normal. And so he kept them apart so that he could have the girls all to himself and they were not to speak to the boys.
It's like Charlie Manson-ish. You know what I mean? Like very much. I think I'm Jesus. My religion is our religion. Oh, I hate it. I hate it. Yeah. Well, now we're getting a little bit out of the family to talk about how the Wessons spooked their neighbors. Mm-hmm. So when Mr. Wesson would go out with the family, the women wore dark robes and they walked behind him in silence with their eyes downcast. Okay. So when the Wessons lived on the tugboat, the girls would row Mr. Wesson to shore and back. Quote, they rowed him like they were slaves, says one neighbor. I had pegged him as some sort of Jonestown cult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Now, as we said before, as Heidi said before, there were boys living in the house and all the boys in the family moved out of the house when they were old enough. I mean, as did most of the girls. However, two of the daughters, Sabrina Wesson and Elizabeth Briani Wesson, and one of the nieces, Rosa Solorio, stayed with their father into adulthood, supporting the family. And there were also several young children still in the house. So now we're in 2003, where the Wessons bought a house in Fresno that had been an office building. So city authorities moved to evict the family because it was a non-residential building. So here we are at 761 West Hammond Avenue near Roding Park. And Heidi, this is the park. This is your park?
I went, this was one of my parks. My grandma Bernice used to take me to Roding Park all the time. And I think it's the biggest park in Fresno. And, it's the zoo is there. It's like an awesome, really, really great place. I've spent many, many happy hours there. And then I remember after all of this went down, when you would drive to Roding Park, you can't help but drive by his house, which you'll get to, is no longer there, but it's changed everything. I don't think you can drive to Roding Park now without remembering what happened there.
That's why we like talking to locals. Beth Malone from Colorado, when we did the Watts family murders, was talking about how it's really difficult to drive past the oil towers that are out there knowing what happened. Yeah. And, it's something that only you know when you live there.
Yeah, especially for a community that's so diverse and enriched probably in so many different cultures and everybody's probably very affected, which anyone would be. And to be honest, we and many people are probably not really sure exactly what precipitated this murder, but the speculation was that the prospect of eviction might have played a part in all of this. On March 12th of 2004, Wesson got a visit from two of his nieces who had moved, Ruby and Safina, and they demanded that Wesson give them their daughters. And Wesson refused, and the family inside shouted curses at the two women, calling them Judas, whore, and Lucifer. So naturally, the two women left without their children, and they returned afterwards. They brought the police because I would. And the officers then ordered Mr. Wesson to come out. But he fled inside the building. So the police called the city attorney, who told them they had no legal right to go inside. And then Rosa Solorio and Mrs. Wesson came out of the building and reported Mr. Wesson had a gun. So police backup and a SWAT team arrived. Now, before I say this, here's the thing. Knowing a lot about real estate at this point in my life, it's pretty incredible squatting rights.
Oh, really?
Squatting rights are pretty incredible. For example, when the police called the city attorney, who told them they had no rights to go inside, that's a true thing. Squatters' rights are a huge, huge thing. And there are so many people, owners of places, who have not been able to evict tenants because of squatters' rights and who have lost buildings over it. So that's something that's amazing to me, because the police could not go inside because of the fact that he lived there and they had no, at the time, warrant to go inside. And it was technically his residence. And that's what's so nuts to me. So thank goodness it was reported that he had a gun. Thank goodness that police backup and a SWAT team arrived. And just as they were taking positions around the house, Mr. Wesson emerges, he covered in blood, and surrenders. And at this point, relatives of the victims completely blame the police for not taking action sooner. So here's where it gets, awful. Not that it wasn't awful before, but when the police went inside, they found 9 bodies of Wesson's daughters and their children. And they were discovered in a bedroom filled with antique coffins. And each victim had been shot through the eye.
I want to say, too, as we were researching this, the children, they weren't in the coffins. We read different accounts that they were in the room with the coffins. We read another account, to your point, Heidi, that the coffins, because it was a small house, those were all in a separate room in the front of the house. So regardless, the kids were there. The coffins were there. It was just a terrible, terrible scene.
And they were young. These kids were like, there were like 3 of them that were 1 babies. Like 3 of them were 1, 2 of them were 4, a 7-year-old, a 17-year-old, and a 25-year-old, and more.
It's also, have either of you ever shot a gun?
I have not.
I have.
I have too. And may I ask, Heidi, were they handguns and or shotguns? Were they both, or rifles of any kind?
a million years ago as a kid, I fired a shotgun on my family's ranch in Modesto. Mm-hmm. That's not far from Fresno. And that freaked me out. I was too little to be doing that. And recently I shot a 22 and a 9mm handgun.
So you'll know then I did shoot a gun once for something about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I will say that the handguns, of course, they ricochet. They're very hard to handle.
Yeah.
And I was astounded to read that they were all shot in the eye. That seems very hard to control. It takes immense control to do that. Unless, I mean, you have to be really close to somebody.
Oh,
you know, and I guess,
it's awful.
If you have experience, I think the more comfortable you are with it. I have not shot guns a lot in my life at all, but I know enough that when you're first doing it, it's shocking. It's very shocking because you've got something in your hand that explodes and you have to learn how to hold it so that you have control over it. And I'm sure for him to do what he did, he must have been familiar with how to shoot that gun. Also, he would go on, as cowards do, to blame his eldest
daughter
for all of it.
Well, and let's get there. He was, of course, arrested and brought to trial. And at his trial, Wesson, represented by public defenders, presented the defense of which you speak, that his 25-year-old daughter, Sabrina, whose 18-month-old son, Marshy, this is Wesson's own son and grandson?
Daughter is also his wife. And so that boy was his grandson and his son.
And they were killed as well. And he's claiming that Sabrina herself committed the murders and then subsequently committed suicide.
Right.
Now, the murder weapon is a 22 caliber handgun. It was found with her body, and her DNA was also found on the gun, which lent credence to his claim.
Right.
Now, the prosecution said Wesson had plenty of time to shoot his children during the 80-minute standoff with police on this date, March 12, 2004. He had closed himself in a back bedroom with the victims, keeping out the mothers whose attempt to get their children out of the home had prompted the police standoff. Now, the prosecutor said in closing arguments that even if Sabrina Wesson did pull the trigger, and I think this is key, Marcus Wesson should still be found guilty if he encouraged her to kill them or was part of a conspiracy that led to their slaughter. Now, the jurors started deliberations on June 2nd, ultimately deciding that Wesson himself pulled the trigger. The verdict read by the court clerk said the panelists concluded he fired the murder weapon.
Of course he did.
So Wesson was convicted of 9 counts of first degree murder on June 17th, 2005, and also found guilty on 14 counts of forcible sexual assault and the sexual molestation of 7 of his own underage daughters and nieces. And that is why we're calling this the Wesson crimes and not just the Wesson murders, because those are heinous in and of themselves. Yeah. So Wesson was sentenced to the death penalty on June 27th, 2005, and is currently incarcerated in San Quentin State Prison.
Yes, he is.
So thoughts, discussions, ladies?
Well, I was talking to my dad about this case. My dad used to be the district attorney in Fresno. He was not DA when this case went down. I know. Thank God. But my dad remembers this case very well. And he knew all the lawyers involved with, you know, defending and prosecuting, et cetera. And the whole thing left this stench in Fresno for a really, really long time. And of course he was convicted. And, you know, one of the things that is so interesting to me is that he was sentenced to the death penalty, and Jerry Brown was governor at the time. Yeah. And they've now in California, all death penalty criminals or everything is on hold, you know, like, because Jerry Brown isn't in favor of the death penalty, mm-hmm. and neither is Gavin Newsom. It's very interesting. But with guys like this, it's sort of like, oh my God, you just want it all to be over with.
Well, yeah, because justice, this is one of those things where it's not, I can't compare it to other, you know, murder one crimes that have happened, etc. But then you think of, when I hear San Quentin, I always think of Scott Peterson, because we do. At least
we heard a dog.
We heard a dog.
Sorry, that's who's Ellie. That's my.
We love Ellie.
That's Ellie. Sorry, guys.
Who doesn't love a dog?
And you know, it's a pandemic. Dogs are going to bark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come on. Dogs are always going to bark. Players are going to play. Haters are going to hate. But I do always think of Scott Peterson sitting there in San Quentin. And I think of all of the real, you know, excuse my French, but fucked up criminals who are in, you know, this majorly maximum secure prison that's very famous for people who have been convicted of such heinous crimes. But this guy is in such a different realm. He's got so many different things, I would say, and like going for him in the worst way ever. He's got like, I'm a cult leader. I'm an incest monster.
Right.
I'm a murderer. And, you know, I really ruined a lot of people's lives. And I was going to actually ask you, Heidi, what it felt like talking to people in the area, you know, if you've ever had conversations with people who lived there or, you know, near there when it happened, if it freaked them out enough to never want to go to that area again, if it was, you know, like all of the, you know, like you said, your dad was not there for the actual SDA to cover the case, but I'm sure he was still affected by it too.
Of course. And I think when a crime like this happens, a small town, medium town, big town, I think that the town, the DNA of the town is forever affected. You become known as the city that, you know, there are raisins in Fresno and there's this mass murder that happened in 2004. And it's like, it's something you can't wash clean. And I remember I lived in San Rafael in like the mid to late 90s for a hot second. And I used to drive by San Quentin because I was fascinated with it's right there. It's like the most beautiful place in the world to have a prison. It's out on a peninsula. Have you driven by or you know?
I do.
Isn't it crazy? Like the times I've driven by, I'm like, God, I mean, I know this is a maximum security prison, but God, if you had to be in a prison,
the view, like when you look at where the prison is, you're like, but it's just so well known for so many people who have committed such
Richard Ramirez.
Unthinkable. I mean, yes, yeah. Richard Ramirez, who we also covered, who for all intents and purposes, the question got raised for him, like, was he born a sociopath or was he made into a sociopath? And he considers himself made into a sociopath.
Interesting. I feel like I haven't seen any interviews with Marcus Wesson, but for me, this is where your first question about like, why am I interested in all of this? There's something about his psychology, about his pathology. And I smell like mental illness on top of whatever crazy egomaniacal thing that was also at play that made him do the things he did. But I think that there has to be some kind of wire crossed in a human brain for you to do the things that he did, because not only is it heinous, and obviously he knew it was heinous, otherwise he wouldn't have killed all those people at the last second. If he thought it was okay, he would have let everybody into his house. But they know it's not okay, which is why at the last minute they go for broke and burn the whole thing down. But I do think that there has to be some kind of mental illness brewing for him to do that. Yeah. Children. I mean, it's
been- yeah. The key for me was the delusions of grandeur that are clearly evident, believing that he's God or Jesus, that he embodies that. And I think we are in agreement. When it involves children, we here at the KIOB find it the most difficult to discuss because they don't have agency.
Yeah.
You know, they're completely dependent on adults. And that's what makes this so difficult. And to your point, yes, clearly his wires were crossed.
But there was a point in time. Mm-hmm. There was a point in time for many years where he was able to rectify in his own brain what he had done.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And that's the part for me when we talk about why are you so into this? I get so intrigued by the fact that someone is able to, in their brain, make something like that okay.
That's right.
I could, like, if I can make things okay in my brain, but the farthest I go is like, I ate bread when I don't want, like, I ate bread and I'm not supposed to have that right now, but it's okay because I'm going to go on my Peloton. So like I can have the bread and that's as far as I will go with that. Right. But the people who are doing these things, like we've talked about so many crimes and so many criminals who do things like kill someone and then continue to live 2 feet away from the person's home for the next 20 years.
Right. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm constantly scanning the subway platform for who's going to kill me.
I understand it now.
Because it's, you know, I do not want to live my life in fear. Of course not. But I think living in New York City, it is kind of a you know, it is a circus out there. And I think there are a lot of scary people that are just waiting to do scary things. And mm-hmm. you hear these kinds of cases and you're like, see, I'm not crazy. There are people out there that are doing things behind closed doors.
Oh, yeah.
And I listen to so much of it. It's too much. I listen to too much of it because where I draw the line is like when an adult woman gets captured and then she's like stuck somewhere in a basement. I'm like, change the channel. I can't.
You're watch. Out.
I'm yeah. out. That's where I draw the line. I just can't stomach it. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that is I have a boundary there.
And especially now in the pandemic, you got to set those boundaries hard. Listen, Belting Heidi Pyre. Is that your nickname? Belting Heidi Vampire Belting Heidi Vampire or Heidi, however you want to call it. Yeah. You're delicious. We love you. You're beautiful. Thank you so much for being here today.
Guys, this was, you know, I hate to say that it was a pleasure to discuss this because it's sort of, you know, disgusting, but it I love seeing you guys.
Well, we love seeing you and thank you for bringing this case to our attention. We probably would never have, thanks girl.
No, seriously, you played in that park and that's, I guess it goes to the thing that we always talk about, like you, no one thinks it can happen in their neighborhood. No one thinks that. Yeah. And I think it's, if anything else, it's a reminder to keep your head up. It can happen anywhere, you know? So really, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, guys. I love what you're doing and I'm in the weirdo club with you.
Another member of the fray who we now lovingly will refer to you as Dr. Blickenstaff. We now always refer to our guests as doctor. Now you are an honorary doctor of weird shit.
Thank you, Doctor.
Dr. Blickenstaff.
Thank you.
Wear it with honor because you never know when you're going to need it.
You never know when you're going to need that baseball bat.
That's right, girl.
That's right.
So bye, Heidi. Love you.
Bye, you guys. Love you.
Banger.
Bye.
She's wonderful.
You know what? She is not only wonderful, she is a treat in every way. She is the best. We are very lucky to have her join us today and to, you know, shed some light on this particular case, which is truly mind-boggling. After even hearing as many cases as we have and being such aficionados of true crime as well, you know, we know you are as well. But to all of our killers out there, we love you. And we thank you so much for listening. Until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.